The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child first and always.
Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. We're very fortunate this month to be talking about some very old topics with Shelley Lawrence from the University of Utah Division of Neonatology. Welcome back, Shelley.
Oh, it's great to be back. Thank you.
Would you like to remind us of your disclosures?
Yes. So my only disclosure is that I'm a co-founder of a startup company that is looking to commercialize a diagnostic for broad pathogen detection. But everything we talk about here has really nothing to do with that.
Terrific. Thanks so much. You really, I think, helped a lot last week in untangling both the importance of syphilis and the clear and present danger of syphilis and also prenatal testing. This week, we wanted to, and that's so key, I think, for me in trying to understand how I approach a newborn, but we want to talk more about newborns this week. Would you mind clarifying just a little bit with the prenatal testing? Are there strengths and limitations of the test based on the stage of pregnancy?
Yes. So thank you for asking me that. I would say that it's not necessarily these tests associated with the gestational age, what you're at in pregnancy, more along what the test actually tests for. So if you're in the earliest stages of syphilis, an RPR or a indirect syphilis screening test is going to have very high sensitivity. But as that disease becomes more latent in women, then it causes less inflammation many times. And so some of those tests are not as sensitive the later in the stages of syphilis that a person can be in. So for instance, the RPR as far as late latent syphilis is only about 75% sensitive. But these antibody tests that test directly for the pathogen is going to have near 100% sensitivity in these later stages. So even in pregnancy testing, what we're recommending is that you have a combination of these tests. In the United States, many centers will start with the CIE or the EIA as their screening test and then reflex to an RPR or TPPA. But if your centers aren't doing that and still primarily use an RPR, at some point, maybe even before the baby goes home, just getting a single CIE or EIA could help find mothers with later stages of syphilis. The other thing is there's a more rapid turnover, so it could help get women home within that 24 hours that most hospitals like to see healthy moms and babies be discharged after a vaginal delivery.
Yeah, terrific. And it gets shorter all the time.
Yes.
I also neglected to ask you about one incredibly important link here. We talked about treating pregnant mothers. We left out one very important link there. And that's what's the recommendation for treating partners of people who are pregnant?
Yes. So I hope even as pediatricians, we realize that it is still our responsibility to try to help the parents find treatment as well. Because as a neonatologist, I've had some moms fall through the cracks and I've had to get them treatment after delivery. But the partner cannot be dismissed. If the partner is not treated, then you know, it's going to be something that comes around again and again and again. So we should talk to the parents and try to treat the mother and her partner or partners as best as we can. And there is a Utah law that helps protect providers who are giving care to partners of the people that they're treating for sexually transmitted diseases. So in this instance, the partner should get a prescription for doxycycline that fits their stages of disease.
And understanding how the prescription is supposed to happen also enables us to say, have you both been adequately treated? That we can ask in a fairly non-judgmental way, given that taking antibiotics can be complicated sometimes.
That is correct. And I'm trying to work with our healthcare system to try to find a pathway to try to help people who don't otherwise have a healthcare provider find the follow-up that they need, because it's not enough just to give them a prescription. They really do need appropriate follow-up to make sure that they have the appropriate decrease in titers and that they don't have more serious infections or co-infections with other things. I mean, we're not necessarily sending lab work on these partners, but they really do. If they have syphilis, they need to work it for other STIs.
And obtaining a prescription can be more complicated than we think sometimes.
Yes, particularly if we kind of send them out on their own and say, you know, we'll follow up with the health department. You know, the health departments do a fantastic job. I can't say enough about the people that do this for a living. They are so empathetic and really care about the patients that they take care of. The problem is that with the rising incidence of STIs, they're really overwhelmed. And so right now, because of the shortage of bicillin, they're trying to make most of their appointments available for women who need to come in and get a dose of penicillin. And so this is their primary focus. That for other people who are non-pregnant or partners, they're really relying on us to help provide that care to these people that have syphilis. We need to step up.
And most effective treatment in the world is not going to help if you're just going to get reinfected during pregnancy.
And then so, it's kind of a waste of the bicillin, right? If we use these doses of bicillin, but then they get reinfected.
We need
to be smart.
We do. So what factors influence the likelihood of vertical transmission?
So it's actually interesting that long ago, there's a law called Sasowitz Law, K-A-S-S-O-W-I-T-Z, that even in 18th century America, they realized that the most commonly transmitted forms of syphilis is when moms are in primary and secondary stages of maternal infection, the earliest stages. But then there's less of a risk of transmitting the disease when you get into the late latent stages of infection. And so the way to look at that today is kind of put numbers associated with it. So if you're a pregnant person and you have the earliest stages of syphilis, the transmission rate is 60 to 100%. But if you get into the later stages of maternal infection, then it's about 40% for early latent infection and 8% with late latent infection. The goal to learn here, though, is that there's not a disease stage of syphilis that you could not give that organism to your fetus.
And as you pointed out last week, some cases are acquired during pregnancy, and that's also a completely different set of risk factors.
Yes. So, you know, the likelihood of vertical transmission does increase with advancing gestational age. However, the stage of development when that baby is infected and how long that inflammatory response has to fester as to how sick that baby is going to be. So if you are infected in very early pregnancy, then that inflammatory response has a long time during organ development to kind of get in there and to cause organ injury and damage. So babies can come out primarily most of the time, 60% of the time they're asymptomatic, but we are starting to see these babies that were probably infected earlier in pregnancy that have just profound end organ damage as far as neuro, their livers, and their platelet counts.
What are you likely to see on ultrasound during development?
So unfortunately, for following ultrasounds in pregnancy, unless the baby has developed very severe cases of congenital syphilis, such as high drops, you may not see anything on fetal ultrasound. You might see some cases that the baby might have some growth restrictions, but ultrasound in of itself is really not sensitive to pick up most types of infections.
So when should I suspect that an infant may be infected?
A large part of when we might expect that a baby's been infected is get a maternal history and to do our screens. So truly, a lot of times it's not what we see on physical exam, it's what we get on our history and then on our screening exams to help us alert to the fact that this mother might have an illness.
Hey, that's medicine 101. Taking
right?
history, do a physical exam.
Yes. A good history and physical exam. There is nothing that trumps.
Then what physical exam findings am I likely to find if a baby's been infected?
Yeah, again, most of the time you're not going to see anything on just a physical exam. I do want to point out, though, that if a baby is born to a mother with active syphilis, that baby is also contagious. because by definition, that baby is getting syphilis through a disseminated manner through the blood into the placenta, into the baby. So the fluids of that baby, amniotic fluid, sometimes they have something called snuffles where they have mucus coming out of their nose. This is all highly infectious with treponemes. And so if you're a healthcare provider or a parent, or who, you know, you're not wearing gloves, you can actually form a canker at the site of inoculation if you touch that baby. So making sure that you have good universal precautions is very important. But most of the time, again, babies are going to show up and they're going to look fine. So this is where you need to do your evaluation. And that evaluation should include a CBC, because many times, again, they have changes in their platelet count. It needs to include, this isn't necessarily a recommendation, but we've seen it enough that I would make it a recommendation, a complete metabolic panel where you look at the liver enzymes, because many times the liver will show some injury. And you also need to do long bone films, because you can see changes at the end of the bone that look kind of moth-eaten, which is very pathognomonic for congenital syphilis. An LP is recommended, but with the LP, I would give just a little bit of advice here. You really need to make sure your platelet count is normal, because we've seen some babies with really profound thrombocytopenia that you never want to put an LP needle in the back of a thrombocytic kid, because then you can risk a hematoma and paralysis. So even if you don't get the LP, it doesn't change your management of the kid if you're going to treat with antibiotics, and it does not change the follow-up of that infant afterwards. Now, this is where the Red Book and the CDC kind of differ, because the CDC's 2021 release of how to treat STIs will say that even if you have cell indices that you suspect that the baby has neurosyphilis, as long as the RPR reverts to negative by 12 to 18 months of age, you've had adequately treated that baby. Now, the Red Book still wants an LP to show that the cell indices are normalizing after 6 months. But again, it doesn't change treatment initially. So if your baby is thrombocytopenic and you can't get an LP, I wouldn't do multiple attempts. The other thing, if you get a traumatic LP, then that traumatic LP shouldn't be sent for testing, because it's contaminated with blood and it may not in and of itself also indicate neurosyphilis. So those are the primary tests you want to get, along with an ophthalmic exam and a hearing screen.
Does the hearing screen differ from the hearing screen that's done as a standard for babies?
No, it's the same test. However, I will say that if your baby does wind up to have syphilis, you know, 60% of kids that have syphilis at birth can have neurosyphilis. And we test that with a VDRL, which is an antibody test. So if mom has given her baby antibodies, it can be falsely positive. And it's not a great test. It only has a sensitivity of about 80%, which is why I have some feelings associated with how important an LP is on some of our infants. If they're fine and healthy, definitely get them. But we've had some really sick kids that they are at higher risk of injury from an LP. And again, it doesn't change the management. So I believe these kids need to be followed in neurodevelopmental clinic, because there was a Canadian study that showed that babies that were inadequately treated or not treated for congenital syphilis had a rate of neurodevelopmental impairment of about 28%. And that can include hearing deficits. So I truly believe that this group of infants not only needs to be closely followed as they grow up as far as their neurodevelopmental potential, but they need frequent ophthalmic exams and they need repeat hearing screens, almost like you would if, you know, you're referring a kid for CMV. Those kids just really need to be followed more closely.
Very helpful. So walk us through optimal treatment of these infants.
Yeah. So first I will say that, you know, treating congenital syphilis is difficult and you have different scenarios. You have less likely to be congenital syphilis, you have possible congenital syphilis, and then you have proven or highly probable congenital syphilis. At the end of the day, I will say if there's any question about whether or not your kid has any signs or symptoms or could be at risk for congenital syphilis, the better part of valor is to treat that kid for 10 days with Crystalin Penicillin G, where you give the recommended dosing, which is 50,000 units per kilo every 12 hours for the first 7 days, and then you change it to every 8 hours on day eight for a total of 10 days. So I first want to say that. The other thing I will say is they usually say if mom's had a fourfold decrease in her titers and she underwent appropriate therapy for her stage of infection within 30 days of delivery, that the baby should be fine. I will say that there's been two cases that we had where we did the full workup and we found bone changes associated with congenital syphilis, that I would caution pediatricians to at least do a workup to make sure that the baby really doesn't have congenital syphilis, because on the outside they can look okay, but when we do our bone changes or CBC or other things, there's things that raise concern that mom might have longer latency of syphilis, that maybe that three dose of bicillin didn't treat it. Now, well, Dr. Florence, why are you saying that? Syphilis can hide in very immune privileged sites in our body, being in our eyes, in our spinal column, other parts of our body where maybe those three doses of bicillin didn't completely eradicate it. And so this is the concern that we're starting to have. There's a fair amount of women, 14%, who remain what we call serofast, where their levels never return to zero. And it's in these women where we think that they've been adequately treated and we think they're serofast and that their titers may never return to zero, that we've had the rare kid that had bone changes associated with syphilis. So I think every baby deserves a thorough examination and some testing.
And that thorough examination, again, just to reiterate, given that a good physical exam may not show very much, includes some laboratory evaluation, as you mentioned, a CBC, a metabolic panel, and x-ray of the long bones.
Yes. And then you can determine whether or not you need to do the LP.
Sure, sure. And again, the population we're talking about here are mothers tested positive. And so if the parent did not receive adequate treatment, then you do the workup. If they received adequate treatment, you would still consider doing a workup.
I would, just because we've seen some of these kiddos that make us wonder if mom doesn't need a more thorough evaluation by a pediatric infectious disease doctor. Now, granted, I work in a NICU. Some of the patients might be outside of what general pediatricians might see. In this case, then, we need to make sure they have appropriate follow-up. So just because you say a baby doesn't have congenital syphilis, mom's titers decreased fourfold during pregnancy, she seemed to be adequately treated, that baby still has to be followed as it grows up in the first year of life. And you want to do an RPR titer at 2 to 3 months, at 6 months, or 6 to 9 months, and then at a year. That RPR titer should become non-reactive by a year of life. And if it starts going up or it doesn't return to negative, then they need, again, have another evaluation, hopefully this time in coordination with pediatric ID, so you can determine if that baby truly was adequately treated.
Okay. Quick question. Is treponema transferred in breast milk?
It is not. However, if mom has a lesion, a chancre, which she can at her breast, that is contagious. And so a baby shouldn't breastfeed wherever there is a lesion around the breast, especially if you think it's syphilis. Now, after mom has been treated appropriately for more than 24 hours of antibiotics, then there should no longer be any treponema in that lesion. However, the AAP recommendation is that she should pump her milk and discard if that lesion's around her nipple and only resume breastfeeding whenever that lesion is completely healed.
And again, given that a chancre is a painless lesion, this means that there should be some instruction about inspection.
Exactly. Yes. Any woman that has any lesion that is around her breast during breastfeeding should be looked at seriously.
Given that we're seeing an increased prevalence, the likelihood of missing some babies is certainly there. What should I be looking for in babies who may present outside the neonatal period?
Yes, I think this is the most important. I did a presentation to our residents because I do believe that we are probably missing cases with the incidence of what we have. It seems to be that it's women that are coming in with no prenatal care that are getting these screens right before delivery, where we need to be, spreading out our net and making sure that we're catching everybody. Now, if you miss congenital syphilis at birth, then you're most likely to see some type of stigmata of late congenital syphilis, usually by 3 months of life, but it can usually be within the first 2 to 8 weeks of life. And sometimes these are going to be kind of soft signs. One of the big things you can see is something called rigottes. And that is where you start getting some, almost, it almost looks like eczema around the mouth or the anus, or it looks kind of dry and can be red, but you start to get little fissures around your mouth or your anus. And that is probably one of the leading things that you can look for, because many of these other things are going to start happening whenever the kiddo grows up and how the bones change and that sort of thing. Sometimes, though, it can show up as deafness. And that's something, again, that you really need to monitor those kids for hearing, because sometimes you can have Hutchinson's teeth and optic nerve injury or cranial nerve, and these can all be like a triad effect. So these kids need to be followed very closely.
And if I develop suspicions, what should I do?
You need to get a history, because after the first—
Wait a minute,
I'm
supposed to take a history on everyone?
Again, a history. You know, the problem is that if it's congenital, then the mother is going to be involved in the transmission of syphilis. But after a few months of age, it's hard to know if there could not be other more nefarious reasons why that kid got syphilis. And we're talking about types of sexual abuse. So we really need to make sure we get that history and test the mom to see if it was passed down from the mom or if we're dealing with a whole different type of syphilis. So usually you start with the mom, and you would want to get the mom's serologies as well as the baby's serologies, and right, then see what those serologies are, and then go from the workup from there.
And the serologies are really going to be the foundation there. The other testing, although there may be some settings where x-rays may be helpful based on what you're seeing.
Yeah, the problem though, those early bone changes that we talked about, those moth-eaten bony changes, those will actually resolve on their own without any treatment. Yeah, so if you don't treat congenital syphilis, those initial bony changes will go away, but what you'll see is other bone changes that will start coming in. So, you know, you can have where the cartilage in the nose gets kind of eaten away, so you get a depression of your nose, or you can get even some mid-face hypoplasia that develops. You can get a broad brow where you get, you know, kind of that, it's called a Olympian brow. But then you can get some other bony changes, such as you can get some kind of hyper growth of your clavicles, and that's called hygomatous sign. It's kind of hard to pronounce, but it's really pronounced clavicles that you can see closer to the sternum. And then you can get some bowing of your tibias, or you can even get some fluid in your joints. It's called gluten joints, where they look like there's a fluid development in there, but it's related to syphilis. So some of those other bony changes, it's very much later in the course of untreated congenital syphilis.
Gotcha. Okay. So a good history and an index of suspicion is probably the mainstay here.
Yes. And it's, I have to stress that once the stigmata of late congenital syphilis starts, you can't reverse it with antibiotics. Once those changes are present, they're present for life. So that's why we really need to try to get these kids treated as soon as we can after birth, so then these problems that arise later don't occur.
Okay. So in the very early stages, a baby that we're seeing, you know, just after delivery, we should be aware that most of these kids are not going to have any signs, but with an index of suspicion, we should at least make sure that we've seen in detail the prenatal labs.
Yes. And I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt here, because this is where it's important. You have to see the labs. You need to see the documented labs from the provider, the lab corporation who did it. I get really suspicious when it's a verbal report on a mother's OB chart, you know, where there's one little line that says on this date, these tests were negative, but you don't see the hard copy of the lab. Because we have actually had one or two babies where there was a misinterpretation of the RPR, meaning that positive meant that it was okay. And so it was reported, like a rubella. If you were immune, you know, you would have some antibodies. and that wasn't adequately followed up as a positive RPR, and hence mother had syphilis. But if you don't have that lab documentation, how do you really know that it was done? So for us, we're really wanting to see that lab documentation. The other thing that's important here is that if the state of Utah doesn't have mom's treatment history documented, it didn't happen. And that kid then is a congenital syphilis case, because let's say mom immigrated from another country where that happened. We don't have it documented, so we can't prove she got treatment. So that is a possible case of congenital syphilis until mom gets documented treatment in the United States.
And the tough thing, too, is that one of my concerns about electronic medical records is I've often referred to them as a way to generate more words with less meaning.
Yes.
The trouble is, we're all subject to this. I am absolutely subject to this, that as you're going through and clicking things in a chart, muscle memory sometimes will put in an erroneous value, and that's tough to deal with.
Yes, I completely agree. If you are a pediatrician who is doing an admission of a newborn, you really need to make sure you go through and you know what mom's hepatitis B surface antigen is, HIV, syphilis. These are all things that you must know before you send that kid home. Because if you miss that, which it's been missed, it is so much harder to capture some of these women and babies and bring them back in for appropriate treatment.
Right. Because as you pointed out before, some of these changes are that treating an illness in its early stages is more likely to avoid some of the terrible consequences.
Agreed. And I will say that the state of Utah has worked really hard to try to help facilitate providers knowing if mothers did get appropriate treatment during pregnancy. So we see this as a referral hospital, that we may not always have mom's record, but there is an a 24/7 epidemiology line that's been established from the Utah State Health Department. And I can give that number for your listeners to make sure that they have it. Now, with this caveat, I would say that it's nice when only one person calls to try to get information
right.
from this line.
Right.
And then that information is nicely charted in the mother's chart so that the pediatrician or neonatologist or whoever else needs it has this information. It is not enough to say mom reports that she's been adequately treated for her syphilis during this pregnancy, the dates that she got her bicillin, and make sure that there's no more than a 9-day lag. So it's important to know treatment. So the state epi line is 888-374-8824. And it's only for pregnant women with syphilis.
That's very helpful.
Yes.
Yeah, and probably something to make sure that we have readily available in nurseries around the state as well.
Correct. But again, these are people who are really dedicated to their job. But if we can try to call with one mom one time and relay the information, that is always greatly appreciated when it's 2 o'clock in the morning.
And given that this, as we've established over the last couple of weeks, can be a little bit intricate, it's nice to have somebody to help walk you through some of the details.
Yes. And they can also help providers kind of help them figure out when to treat. But then again, we're here too. If you're a provider and you're in a place of Utah that hasn't seen cases yet, I'm always available. My colleagues at the University of Utah in neonatology is always available, as well as my pediatric ID colleagues. So we're here to help, and we're here to make sure you make the right choice.
Yeah, the take-home message of this podcast is that the collaboration makes everything better. We really appreciate you sharing your expertise on podcast as well as in your career. Shelly, thanks so much for spending time with us. We're going to shift topics next week. Are you willing to come back again?
Oh, yeah. No, this is great. You can have me anytime.
Okay, terrific. We'll talk next week, because life is confusing. We're going to talk next week about gonorrhea.
Yeah, exactly. Keeping with the STI theme.
All right. For those of you who have questions, please send your questions to questions@vcurb.com, and we'll deal with those in a couple of weeks. Shelly Lawrence, thanks for your time. We'll talk to you next week.
Sounds great.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.